Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Ronnie Fuller. Fuller is a poet who's been working on his craft for over 50 years. He believes his work has become more straightforward and powerful following the death of his wife Betsy in 2004. He's published two books in recent years that cover that period in his life, called God's Breath and A Reason for the Wind, both published by Ithaca Publishing House, Vista Periodista. Welcome to the show, Ronnie. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Now, I want to begin at the beginning. You started writing poetry when you were 16. Do you remember what prompted you?
Loneliness, probably. I don't think I fit in to any sort of mold of other students in my high school that I knew. And I was an individualist from day one, I guess. And somehow this seemed to be a way that I could express myself in an individualistic way. And it started me off, and here I am, still doing it.
That's great. You also are of the generation that obviously got in, a lot of them got involved in politics in the 1960s, Vietnam and so on.
Absolutely.
Were you writing political poetry at that time?
I was writing political poetry, and I have, you probably can't tell too much by reading these particular books, but over the years, there have been considerable political emphasis on in various poems that I have written.
Well, let's talk about 1974. You were working as a paralegal in Washington.
1974.
And you met someone very special who you ended up marrying. Tell us about that time.
I had come from the West Coast and had gotten this job as a paralegal in the Housing Section, Civil Rights Division, Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. I had been working there for about 9 months, I believe, when a new attorney arrived, Betsy Fuller, Betsy Cohen, I should say, Sarah Betsy Cohen, who had just graduated from Stanford Law School. She had come and taken this job in Washington, D.C. Principally, she had other offers, and she had taken this job principally because her mother was at that time dying of breast cancer. And she wanted to be near her. And in fact, her mother, she arrived in October, I believe, of 1974. And her mother died that following December.
And so you two met. And
we met and actually never went on a date.
Really? You met and then immediately married?
Not quite that. But we became friends and then very good friends and 6 months later, best friends. And on July 4th weekend of 1975, we went camping and we became lovers. And that was a very, very short time after that. We married the following October. But it was just, it was a very natural, easy process. It was one of the most easy, I guess easy is the way to describe this, because everything fell into place naturally. I would recommend that everybody become best friends with their future spouses first, but I know that doesn't always work. But it worked for me, and it was a wonderful experience and turned out to be a wonderful marriage.
Now, your first child was born, and you moved to the Navajo Nation in Arizona.
That's correct.
To tell us how what that was like.
That was when I retired officially from my job as paralegal and took up residence in outside of Tuba City, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation, and became a house husband.
Wow, that's fascinating to me.
Betsy was working for Navajo Legal Aid at the time, and I settled in with our son, Jonah,
and became
very happily becoming a house husband, cooking, cleaning, a little bit of cleaning. I'm not a terribly good housekeeper, but I'm a great cook.
Well, was that a natural transition for you, too? Because that's very unusual for a male to have done that, especially in that time. More are doing it now, but...
More doing it now. I don't know that I was particularly a role model for anyone to come, but in terms of our own situation, it seemed a very natural thing to do. Betsy was a lawyer, could clearly make more money than I could, and I did not have a particular need to demonstrate to the world that I was somebody defined by the job that I had.
Yeah. Because so much status is, you know...
There's status for, are you an engineer?
Relegated to what you do. Yeah.
It was easy. It was easy. And it was a decision that we made together. We would sit down and we'd say, does this make sense? Yes, it makes sense.
Uh-huh. But you were writing poetry during all
this
time,
too. But I was writing
time
poetry
too, so it gave you time
the whole time.
To hone your skill as
cooking
well.
Cooking and writing poetry and taking care of Jonah.
Uh-huh. Now, you ended up publishing 2 books of poetry in recent years, and most of them cover the period when Betsy was dying and after her death, and then you trying to rebuild your life.
That's correct.
Was this... To tell us a little bit about this, how it affected you.
There was a period of time from probably starting in 1999 when Betsy was originally diagnosed with breast cancer. She went through the process of chemotherapy and radiation and seemed to be doing very well. She had some lingering problems of lymphedema, but actually she was recovering very nicely, and we thought, well, that's it. We've gone through that, and as is the case more and more, As the medical procedures surrounding breast cancer get better and better, more and more people are able to survive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So shortly after all these treatments were done, she applied for a Fulbright grant and was granted this. She was very fluent in Spanish. And we moved to El Salvador, where she consulted with a university in El Salvador. During this time, actually, I wrote a great deal of poetry while we were in El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
It always seems to stimulate me to go to a new place and see new things.
Yeah, you can almost rediscover yourself.
Exactly. Very, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. So we were there and had a wonderful experience, went back in the next 2 years. A couple of times, actually went back to the wedding of a good friend of ours who married a Salvadoran. And during that time, shortly after that time, she contacted an agency in Mexico City, and went down and interviewed with them. This was a job which would have to do with working with the court system of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Mexico City in November of 2002, rented an apartment. She took the job. They were waiting for her. Everyone was terribly happy. We were going to go there perhaps for 5 years. It was an exciting adventure. And virtually on the weekend that she was to first go down and start the job, she had a biopsy. And it turned out to be positive, and her cancer had metastasized. This is sort of a long explanation to say that during this period, there was just a great deal going on in both of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequent to the diagnosis, there was almost a year and a half that she lived after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I assumed the only proper role that there was for me to assume, which was that of primary caregiver for her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I certainly did it willingly. After she died, there was a sudden cessation of the activity of that that life had been for several years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as a poet, I took the road that I thought was made most sense to me, which was to write poetry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I want to have you read from your volume. It's A Reason for the Wind is the volume. The poem's called Erev Yom Kippur.
Erev Yom Kippur. There were times, I know, this past year, when I could have been more thoughtful. The last few days I stayed all day, all night, trying to ease you into the inevitability of death. I know I might have stayed before all night, knowing your fear, but I went home, thinking I must recuperate my strength, assuring you I would drive carefully and watch for deer. There were so many more times, and now, on behalf of you, I must forgive myself for anything this past year that has caused you pain. And I must ask, on your behalf, because you cannot ask yourself, for me to forgive you for leaving me. It is an absolute requirement. If someone asks for forgiveness and is genuine in the request, you must accept. You must forgive. I will forgive you, as I must, the one most terrible thing you ever did.
Hmm. Wow. Now you converted to Judaism in the early 1980s. How has your faith helped you through this?
Being a Jew is an extremely important part of my life, and one of the points of genius of the Jewish religion is that it takes care of life cycles, and there is something to do, and there is somebody there to tell you this is the proper thing to do at this point.
So you were able to follow rituals.
So you follow the ritual, and with that ritual you know that the first 7 days of sitting Shiva, you do certain things. Then the first month of Shloshim, there is a prescribed ritual, and then you can continue on throughout the year. You say Kaddish for the first year, and then at the anniversary of a person's death, you will say Kaddish again for forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's this ritual, just as the holidays come at predictable times, and there's also the ritual that you go through for grief and mourning.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a template that you have that you go through, and then within that template you can figure out what makes sense to you.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And what made sense to me was writing poetry.
Mm-hmm. And did you follow some of these rituals with your children? I know you and Betsy ended up having three children.
Three children. We had three children, and yes, I followed the, going to say religiously. A bit pretentious, but yes, I did follow these rituals, and it was good. It was very, very good to be able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Before the first year of mourning was up, I spent 2 months in El Salvador living with friends that we had made there previously. And it was so much. It was difficult in many ways to be there, where I had known so many things with Betsy and done so many things with her. But the religious part of it was extremely good, because I would go every Friday night and every Saturday morning to the only synagogue in the entire country where I knew many people, and I would stand and say Kaddish. And that was the rhythm of it, which was immensely helpful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ronnie Fuller. He's a poet. You and Betsy lived on a kibbutz in Israel as well.
That's right. We and our three children spent a year on a kibbutz Hanaton,
And had you already converted to Judaism by then?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I had. Yes,
so that must have been quite meaningful for you.
Oh, it was extremely meaningful. And it was a religious kibbutz of the Masorti movement, which is conservative, called conservativeness in this country.
And is it really? Because that surprised me. I mean, you've described yourself as such an American lefty.
Oh.
to be on a conservative kibbutz sort of seems counterintuitive.
I do consider myself somewhat of a lefty. And the name conservative in terms of Judaism is a misleading one sometimes. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know, I mean, it has nothing to do with right-wing, left-wing.
No.
It's the kind of Jewish service that you have. Anyway, it's not the official religion of Israel is Orthodox.
Right.
And so this small conservative movement was pretty much confined in some ways to this kibbutz, where many of the people, I might say, were extremely liberal in their politics.
Now, I want to get you to read another poem from A Reason for the Wind. This one's called Finding You.
This was written, I might say, during this 2-month period that I spent in El Salvador. I would like to do such wonders here inside the sea, swimming as my imagination might dictate, always without effort, forgetting who I was. Then I would sing such a song as the waves roar out, finding the notation for chaos. And I would lift myself above the waves, and without thought, fly with wings or arms, just missing the surge of the waves. And again I would dance with the waxing moon as partner, echoing my shadows on the sand. And then I think I would find you.
Hmm. Now, do you feel that you were finally surfacing from your intense grief in that poem? It seemed to me that you were surfacing.
Yes. I think that's fair to say this. Part of what came about through this process of writing poems, and in the first book, In God's Breath, it takes me through, as I recall, about 2.5 months following her death.
Mm.
And then this new book, Reason for the Wind, continues that process more or less for the next 15 months. And as I read them over again, I can see this, I think more than I felt when I was actually writing these poems, I think I can see now this process of opening out, looking more toward what is around me outside,
mm-hmm. Being able to see
coming out
again.
Of the grief.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I can say you ever come out totally from mm-hmm. grief. There are people who have expected me to be a completely different person suddenly.
Really?
We've gone through this mourning process, and now let's get on with life. And I don't see it that way. I see it as a process which is individual to each person who happens to be grieving for the loss of a loved one. Mm-hmm. And I'm taking my time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm letting it happen as it will happen.
Uh-huh. Did you ever consider not sharing some of these intensely personal poems?
It was especially with the first book, where there's a certain rawness, I might say, in terms of the mm-hmm. grief, because it started during the first 7 days of Shiva after Betsy died. And it took me some time to convince myself and let others convince me as well that I could open out and mm-hmm. share these with other people.
Mm-hmm. And how did your children react to them? I assume they've read them.
not much.
Mm, really?
They are not able to. they're quite, they've told me that someday we will sit down and read these, but it's still too soon. We can't deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said in the biography that you sent me that you feel like Betsy's death has made you a better poet.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So tell us
well,
why.
Well, in over 50 years of writing poetry and being, for the most part, my own teacher, which is a very pretentious thing to say, but I have not had, with a few minor exceptions, I have not had outside teachers. And
I always think of life as the teacher.
Well, life is a teacher, and reading the great poets is a wonderful teacher.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I have, over the years, done a great deal of experimentation, and it was my time with Betsy, who was extremely supportive of my being a poet and my writing as much as I wanted to. Mm-hmm. One of the things she started to teach me is to be a little bit more straightforward in my poetry. She always appreciated...
Does straightforward mean accessible?
Accessible.
Accessible,
exactly.
Okay.
Accessible.
Mm-hmm.
She liked to read my poems and not have to think too hard about what the subject was, for example.
Uh-huh. What do you mean you don't know what
yeah,
I meant?
You
just don't get it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I haven't totally abandoned that particular obscure style, but when I started writing these poems for her, about her, to her, it seemed to make a great deal of sense to me that I be extremely forthright mm-hmm. and saying, this is what I feel, and this is what is going on inside of me, and this is how much I loved her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the flow of the poems that came out was very good. It was very good, and it was very natural. They just came out, and more so in the first book.
And did they come out intact, or did you have to do a lot of polishing?
There, in the first book particularly, much of them came out intact.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of the longer poems in the first book that took more revision because they were written in a more formal style of
mm-hmm.
blank verse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to have you read one more poem
yes.
before we run out of time. This is also from A Reason for the Wind, and it's called I Wanted to Tell You.
This also was written in El Salvador, as you'll be able to tell. We never went to Chalatenango, but on the road there going east, I went now to El Paraíso, City of Paradise. I passed the pineapple district, dozens of roadside stands selling piña, ripe, sweet. Nearby a bridge crossed the corner of the lake. Did we stop, you and I, to see the 1,000 egrets on our way to La Palma? They were there again in the shallows, the northwest corner of Lago Suchitlan. Flying above the egrets was a wood stork, its neck stretched out. I came back here wanting to tell you. One of the things that makes me think of is that during the first year particularly, I would go to a lecture and be inspired by something, and there would be this moment where I'd say, oh, I can't wait to tell Betsy about this.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, there probably always will be a fine line between thinking Betsy's still there and being able to start a new life.
Absolutely.
We're almost out of time. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a new book of poetry, which may or may not have, as part of it, selections from a journal which I kept when I lived in El Salvador. It's tentatively called A Jew in El Salvador, and I should say first that part of what is in this are the time that I spent after Betsy died So there's a section there, and then there's a section also of when we were living there and then visiting a few times. So there's a whole range of times and experiences which I have developed into a book, and I hope it will be good. I hope it will be good. I've been working hard on it. I've had a couple of readers go through it and make suggestions, which make me go back to the poems and revise. But that's it.
So life is going on for you?
Life is going on for me. Life is good. I have two grandchildren now and who are wonderful, and life is good.
Thank you, Ronnie Fuller, for being with us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.